Colonel Smiley, Regal 2.
I remember the first Italian air raid, and in fact several others, on the oil refineries at Haifa, which was the first air raid I think I'd seen in the war, and it was quite effective. They did hit some of the oil tanks, because I remember them burning for about a week and smoke filling the sky. We were down at Tulkarm, and you could see the smoke from Haifa. I was up at Haifa, actually, in a hotel when it first air raid happened, and I was sitting on the terrace, Windsor Hotel on Mount Carmel, and I could see the airplanes coming over and dropping their bombs. It was quite some interesting at that stage before one knew really what to expect in air raids.
Was that 1914?
That was 40 years. I'm trying to think what else of interest. We moved from Tulkarm eventually up to the north to the boundary between Syria and Palestine, and we patrolled the boundary. It was a wire fence called McTaggart's Wall. It was right stretching from the sea right across to Lake Tiberias, or the northern Lake Tiberias, and the idea was to patrol it against smugglers of arms and smugglers of drugs. Even in those days, drugs were being smuggled. In fact, I did a period on duty with the customs people, Ras Nakura, that's on the coast between Beirut and Haifa. I mean, it's on the frontier between Haifa and Beirut. And I remember being with a policeman one day who, I was with him, he was a Palestine policeman, and he said to me, there's hashish in this car. And I said, how do you know that? He said, I could smell it. And the car had, they were Arabs, and he made them get out, and he had a skewer, like a sort of thing on meat, and he started prodding about, and suddenly he got a bit into the back of the driver's seat, brought it out, and he showed me a little bit of white powder. He said, that's hash. And then he pulled all the upholstery apart, and we found, I think about 40 or 50 little packets of white powdered stuff, which he said was hash. And, of course, we arrested the people inside, who, of course, all swore they knew nothing about it at all. But, I mean, there are lots of ways of smuggling. They used to in the cars, they used to put stuff in motor tires. I believe they had parking plugs made of gold, and they're smuggling gold, and they used to put tubes down camels' throats with hashes and things and drive them across the frontier and then kill them the other side and take the tubes out. There were all sorts of extraordinary ways they smuggled things in those days. And it sounds rather funny talking about smuggling drugs in 1940 when it's now 1988 and full-scale business.
Whilst you were in Palestine at that time, you were talking about having a bodyguard. How much in danger did you feel through being assassinated?
Not the least. We all thought it was rather unnecessary, but it was laid down from up above. And so it was just orders, or I don't know what, it was an army order, or what. It wasn't a regimental thing, it was done from a higher level. We thought it was rather a waste of time, really.
Did you know of anybody in your unit who was killed?
Or? No, nobody in my unit was, but certainly some were in others. I think that is the reason. There have been some officers murdered, and that is the reason for the order. But we didn't feel terribly threatened.
What happened to you after Palestine?
What happened
to you after Palestine?
Well, actually, while I was in Palestine, I was getting particularly cheesed off, doing nothing, while the war had started, and Wavell's push had started, and people were, Italians were being surrendering in vast numbers, and we were all just wandering about on our horses. I felt very frustrated, and they asked for volunteers to go into the Somaliland Camel Corps, and I volunteered, and I went down, joined a ship at Suez, and went down the Red Sea with a lot of other cavalry officers who'd done the same thing, including one called McLean, Billy McLean, who was later to become a great friend of mine. And when we got to Berbera, they'd decided to evacuate Somaliland. There was only one battalion of Black Watch there who'd done extremely well in holding up a whole battalion division. But anyway, we decided to quit. And we took people on board. There was an air raid. And we came back to Suez. When we got to Suez, there was a RTO who I knew, and he said, "Oh, you've got to go back to your regiments." And I and Billy McLean said, "Oh no, we don't want to do that. We want to get into the war. We'll go to Cairo and see what we can do." So we both got on a train to Cairo, and Billy went to one person who he had contact with, who happened in fact to be in MO4, which became SOE, and I went and saw General Wavell, because General Wavell was a personal friend. I knew I had the next door room to his son at Sandhurst, and he and Lady Wavell were great, well, they were Mr. General and Mrs. in those days, were great friends of my mother's, and when I was at Sandhurst, I mean, I knew the Wavell family. And I said to him, "Can you do anything to help me get into the war? Because I don't think I'm going to do any good sitting on a horse in Palestine while all the battles are going on in the Western Desert." He said, "Well, I think I can, because we're forming a new unit out here called a commando. We've never had one before. You go and see Brigadier Scherer, who's my director of intelligence, and he'd probably be able to fit you in." So I then went and saw this brigadier, who said, "Yes, we're looking for officers, and if you volunteer, we'll be able to accept you, but you've got to go back to your regiment until you're sent for." So I went back to my regiment, and only after about a week, myself and another officer and quite a number of men who'd volunteered were all sent to back to Egypt. And I joined then what is called the Middle East Commandos, number 52, it's called Middle East Commando. And we started off based at Geneva on the Suez Canal, which was one enormous camp. I mean, Geneva stretched for miles, and as far as the eye could see, there were tents and different units and regiments and things were all stationed on the canal. And at first, the officers had to have about 2 weeks' training from experts in their various... I'd already done a course on mines and demolitions. I was quite proficient at demolitions already, but we did more mining and demolitions, and we had courses in unarmed combat and this, that and the other, boat work on the canal. And having done this, we then got the troops, and then we, as the officers, had to train the troops in these various combined operations, mainly on water, landing on sort of land, from going from a boat or submarine or what have you. We're training for all this, and of course what eventually happened, they sent us all down to Abyssinia. We put in a boat in Port Said, looking as if we were going to go north. In fact, we went down the Suez Canal, past Suez and down the Red Sea, and got off at Port Sudan, put in a train to a place called Gadarif, and then marched 100 miles up to what was then the front line between the British and the Italians, which was just, there was a village called Galabat and another one called Matema. Galabat was just in Sudan, and Matema was just in Abyssinia, which was of course in those days occupied by the Italians. And the Italians had captured Galabat and then been driven out again. And we were just put there as sort of frontline troops holding a line and sending out long-range patrols behind the Italian lines. And it really wasn't a commando's role at all. I mean, we'd been training to get off ships and land on islands in the Greek islands and things like that. And we were just used as sort of extra infantry, really. But we did quite a lot of patrols, and we had quite a few fights. I was a company commander then. I got promoted from being a lieutenant to a captain. I commanded a company as a captain. Three companies, in fact, we had there. And we did these long-range patrols, and we did have a certain amount of success. And it obviously made the Italians jittery, because after we'd been there about, I don't know how long, was there, two, three months, the Italians withdrew right the way back to Gonda, which was the sort of, we were attacking the main road to Gonda. That was our main role, sort of going 10 or 15 miles behind the Italian lines and laying ambushes on these roads. And we were withdrawn, by which time we had a number of casualties, more from malaria than the enemy. We didn't have very many from the enemy, a few killed. But we were withdrawn, and the whole commando was sent to Alexandria.
Could I just ask you a little bit about this these operations on the Abyssinian frontier before we leave it. How did you find the calibre of the Italian forces you were fighting against?
Most of the troops we fought against were native levies. They were Eritreans, I suppose, and Somalis, various sorts. But we found the calibre of the Italian officers and NCOs extremely high. They were what they call colonial army officers, and judging by my experiences later in the Western Desert, I think the standard of officer and NCO in Abyssinia, in the Italian army, was very high. And the troops were good soldiers. They were quite happy to change sides. They weren't entirely pro-Italian. We used to have Abyssinians with us who'd go shouting through loudspeakers, come and join us, sort of thing, you know, and quite a lot did, you know. But they fought quite well when we had our little battles with them. As I say, and when it was all over, there was general agreement, I know, among most of us, that the Italian were quite a high standard.
And so those who defected would fight just as well against the Italians as for them, would they?
The natives, yes, the native troops. A lot of them were quite happy to defect. Funny enough, one of the extraordinary things I did notice was when we took prisoners, which occasionally we did, not very often, but if they were taken down the line from Galabet down to Gadarif, which was a big base, and there was a prisoner of war camp in Gadarif, and within a week of any of those men being taken prisoner, their wives and children would be sitting outside the camp handing them in food. The sort of bush telegraph would say, oh, so-and-so's been captured, and the whole family would move down through the sort of lines on both sides and sit outside the camp looking after kith and kin. It's quite extraordinary how quickly the news got around, how quickly they got down there.
Did you capture much in the way of material from the Italians there?
Only when they moved back to Gondar, because we followed up. We didn't go all the way to Gondar, we were stopped. But where they evacuated their first front line position, we didn't find very much in the way of arms, but we found a lot of, great deal of food and wine. We found quite a lot of hospital supplies, but nothing, they'd taken all their weapons and equipment with them. They hadn't got very, I mean, most of them only had rifles and machine guns. There was nothing there. They did have some artillery, very little. Most of their bombing was done by CR-42s. They did have complete air superiority. I mean, we never saw a British fighter ever. But I believe there had been one. Well, there had been one shot down, and we saw it wreck near Galabet. It was a Gloucester Gladiator in those days, a sort of rather old-fashioned fighter. But we saw the Italian airplanes every day. They came and bombed us, but they weren't very accurate.
How would you set up one of those ambushes?
Well, we would do it. We'd do approach march. We'd move perhaps 24 hours by day, and perhaps another 3 or 4 hours by night, and it required a certain amount of good map reading. There weren't really very accurate maps of the area, but we had the river to go by. There was we were on what they call the Atbara River, and the Atbara was a tributary of the Nile, in fact, and we used the river as our main guide. And there were quite a lot of features, hills and things, which one could see through the bush, and they were all given names. And the Italians were on them. We used to go and then move up onto the road. There was only one road. It was a track more than a road. It wasn't tarmac. It was used by vehicles and mules mainly. And we'd lie up waiting till a convoy came along, and then we'd just shoot it up and try and take a prisoner if we could, and then beetle off. So by the time it was daybreak, we were well away from the area where we'd laid ambush. They were quite successful. I know we killed quite a number of Italians and captured occasionally. My company captured a mule on one occasion. We took the mule all the way back to our lines. No, about 2 days later it escaped and went all the way back to the Italian lines, I think.
Yeah, I interrupted your narrative with you leaving Abyssinia. Can you pick it up from there?
Which bit? When
I interrupted your narrative.
Oh, sorry. After Abyssinia, yes, we moved back We marched back to Gdaref, which annoyed us, because it was 100 miles, and we reckoned they could have taken us in lorries. And then from Gdaref we went to a place called Kassala, Jebel Kassala. It was a bit of desert, with a huge flat mountain sticking out of this desert, which, funnily enough, I've seen recently on the television, because there's a vast camp where there's thousands of starving people. It's one of those places where all the starving people go to. Anyway, we were at Kassala for about 2 or 3 weeks, and then we had very bad casualties from malaria, and we were thinning out considerably. We didn't have any precautions in those days. There were no pills and things. We did in Palestine, fine enough, but we didn't in the commandos. Anyway, they sent us back to Alexandria to do dock guards, and we were there for about 3 weeks, and it was at that time that we were busy evacuating Crete and Greece. And the ships, we were on duty in the docks when the ships came in with all the survivors from Greece and Crete. And that was quite interesting in itself. The Navy were absolutely fantastic, how they came in and disgorged all these troops. And again, it was rather an eye-opener how the troops themselves appeared. I mean, some had all their weapons and sort of marched off the boat. Others had obviously thrown all their weapons away and came off as a sort of disorganized rabble, you know. And there were different units. Some were good and some were bad. The Australians were pretty bad, I might add. They came out very badly at that particular stage of the war. We had awful trouble in the docks, because all they wanted to do was get a drink and a woman or something. And they were supposed to be put on trains, taken back to transit camps for training and all that sort of thing. And these chaps just disappeared, and we had to keep on arresting them, putting them back, you know. They were very aggressive too, so were the commanders for that matter, so we held our own. But I mean, there was a lot of sort of fisticuffs, to say the least. It wasn't very nice, quite honestly. But anyway, we had quite a lot of air raids on Alexandria when we were there, and they were quite severe at times. But we heard through the grapevine, because one didn't hear an awful lot about what was going on elsewhere, we heard that my regiment, the Household Cavalry, had lost their horses, had been re-equipped with trucks, and were going into action in Iraq against Iraqis. And I heard this from somebody, I think in a bar in Alexandria, and as we'd been sitting for 3 weeks doing nothing except guarding the docks, I applied to my colonel. I was only, as I say, I was a captain, but I was a company commander. I said, can I go back to my regiment, because I heard last they're going into action. And he said, well, it doesn't look as if we're going to do anything. You might as well. So I applied for transfer and got it. So did another officer in my regiment and 2 or 3 troopers. And so we went back. We left the commandos in Alexandria and went back to Palestine. I got to Haifa, and the regiment already left its last. It was in the north somewhere, and they'd got trucks, and they were driving across the desert from Jordan into Iraq with the object of raising the siege of a place called Habaneh, where there were British troops surrounded by Iraqis. And the brigade I was in, 4th Cavalry Brigade, was sent to try and raise this siege complete. It wasn't only a cavalry brigade, it was also an infantry battalion and various other, some RAF armoured cars. It was a mixed bunch. But anyway, I caught up with it before it had got to Habaneh. And I left. That was the last I had to do with the commandos. But it did happen that about 2 or 3 weeks after I left the commandos, they were suddenly ordered to Crete. And they formed a rear guard while all the troops were eventually evacuated, and most of them, about 90% or more, were left behind and taken prisoner, except for one or two who took to the mountains and later escaped. But that was the end of that commando, 52. In fact, all the commandos in the Middle East were then disbanded at the same time. They had when we were in Alexandria, a force of commandos came out from England called Lay Force, under command of General Bob Laycock, who, funnily enough, was the adjutant of the Blues when I joined, and he was a Royal Horse Guard, but he became head of combined operations later, but he was the head of this commando force, and Lay Force had three battalions. And when they arrived in these ships called the Glen ships in Alexandria, the three Middle East commandos, 50 and 51 and 52, were amalgamated and called D Battalion Lay Force, so we all became part of Lay Force. And they were, unfortunately, had rather a checkered career, and most of A and D battalions, I think, were sort of captured in Crete. A was an infantry, A were infantry regiments, B were brigade of guards and cavalry, C were Scottish, and D were Middle East. The Scottish had terrible casualties. They did a raid on the French. We were then fighting the French in Syria, and they raided. They had to cross the Litani River, and the Navy put them on the wrong side of the river, the south side instead of the north, and they were practically decimated, the officers anyway, under Geoffrey Keyes in those days, and they were eventually disbanded. B Battalion was disbanded, and fun enough, on disbandment, instead of going back to their regiments, one or two people, David Sterling in particular, went and saw Wavell and put over his ideas of what became the SAS, and Wavell accepted his ideas, and the first SAS were formed out of officers of D Battalion, of B Battalion Lay Force, when they started their training, again down at Cabrete on the canal. That's when the SAS first started. But that was because all those commandos, Middle East commandos, were disbanded, and various officers, most went back to their units, some went back to England, and it was rather sad, really, because it was a good idea. But they just weren't really used properly. We trained in Alexandria for occupying various Greek islands, roads and places, and we practiced this and practiced that. Never came to anything at all. They never did any operations like that. Well, they did capture one place, Kastellaritsa, actually, off the Turkish, little island off the Turkish coast they captured.
Now, coming back to your own story with Iraq, can you tell me in detail about the part that you played in those operations for the relief of...
Yes, I rejoined the regiment. I was given a troop. I came down again from captain to be a lieutenant. And a troop consisted of four trucks. We were in 1,500-weight trucks. And the drivers had taken over those trucks, having handed in our horses, and straight away shot across the desert to the relief of Habaneh, and there was no training, practically, in driving or maintenance at all. And they were really first-rate, the way they managed to keep these things on the road. I mean, there wasn't a road. It was with the track from Haifa, I suppose. It went, the pipeline, it's called the H pipeline, and there were sort of pumping stations on the way called H1, H2, H3, and so on. And it went to Habaneh, and we got outside Habaneh, and I remember the first battle, as it were. I was the advanced troop, and there was a station, there was a railway line which went from Baghdad up to Mosul, so running due north and south, originally built by the Germans, I believe, in the 1418 war, part of the Berlin to Baghdad line. Anyway, there was a station there, and as we went down the main road, which ran parallel to the station, we were fired on, and I was told by my squadron leader, somebody called Sir Gerard Fuller, to try and capture the station. So we went forwards, first of all in our cars, until bullets started whistling around. So we dismounted from our cars, sent them back, and I crawled up with my troop up the side of the railway line, a sort of slight embankment at the side of the railway line, and we got within 200 or 300 yards of the station. We opened up with what weapons we had, which were pretty miserable in those days. We had Hotchkiss guns, which were ghastly, jammed every 5 minutes. Funny enough, we trained in Bren guns just before the war. I was a weapon training instructor at one moment. I did a course on Bren guns down at Hythe, and as soon as the war started, We had to give up all our Bren guns to the BEF, the British Expeditionary Force, and we were issued these frightful Hotchkiss guns, which had a sort of a round drum on top of ammunition. It wasn't belt-fed, it was drum-fed, and as I say, they were jamming endlessly. Anyway, I had one per section, I think, so I had four Hotchkiss guns in my troop, and we opened up on the station, and all the Iraqis up tools and fled, and we charged into the station and found quite a lot of equipment and stuff, and the station was ours. We pulled down their flag, and that was that, and then we moved on.
What kind of equipment did you find?
Well, they left some weapons behind, including Bren guns, and this was the most extraordinary thing, is that the Iraqis had Bren guns against our Hotchkiss guns, and so of course we took them over and used them from then on.
Did you have any prisoners?
At that station, no, but the next station was more interesting because we were joined by GLUB and a lot of the Arab Legion troops. We call them the GLUB girls. They had long flowing hair and they were absolutely wonderful. They knew the way in the desert. We used to have a truckload of them with us, and they always knew where the wells were and who the local tribe. They nearly always had a man from the local tribes and so on. They were really frightfully useful. And I'd met GLUB before on that particular operation. He'd come in. I met him at Habaneer, I think. No, I met him before Habaneer. That's right, because the next station we attacked, El Kadamein, I think it was called, we attacked it by charging in our trucks. And GLUB had brought some of his men with him. And there were about four of mine, I think there were about 30 trucks, went charging towards this station. And I was in truck with GLUB together. And he had his men, about four trucks loads of them. And they were shouting and yelling. And we got to the station and the enemy had more or less fled, but there were still quite a lot of men there getting out of their uniform and putting on their dish dashes, but one knew at once that they were soldiers because they didn't take their boots off. And a lot of things went on at the station. The GLUB girls tried to blow up the safe, which they succeeded in doing, but it only had railway tickets inside and no money, which they hoped. But I saw GLUB giving money to some of these men who had been our enemy. They were men who'd just been changing out of uniform. And I said, "What on earth are you doing to those men?" He said, I'm recruiting them. They're joining me now." And he was recruiting them on the spot into the Arab Legion.